3CR in Melbourne, and it's distributed nationally via the Community Radio Network Service of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia. The music you've been listening to is called Wonderful Tonight by Noonday Underground, and the theme music for Women on the Line is Kerri-Ann Cox's She's Got a Story Too. I'm Sheila Ryan.
So make you happy, so make you sad, so make you cry, so make you mad.
The program you just heard was recorded in 2006, but Australia's Women's Circus and its National Institute of Circus Arts are still going strong. Wings thanks Women on the Line and 3CR Radio for this shared content. Thanks also to all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose salons can be viewed at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Good morning and welcome to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO is, as you know, a volunteer-powered community platform, which means we are funded by you, the listener. Today, Matthew of KBOO's Gremlin Time.
Catch us up with the recent My Salinger Year.
But first, here are some quick takes on a few recent television shows.
If you are one of those people like me who thinks that TV shows are better than movies these days, it becomes a bit of a painful time of life when you fall into that between season period, when some of the shows that you were following closely, such as Poker Face or Succession, end practically on the same day. And there's a gap of several weeks before shows that sound interesting start to pop up. This notion that TV shows are better than movies these days is a function of two qualities. One, especially if they're adapting a novel, they have more time to explore characters and also invent new plot complications. But the other factor is that TV shows now look as good as movies. You will recall, maybe, if you were a kid watching Columbo, how you realized that all the Universal shows had the same kind of credits and all were shot in sets that were super over-decorated, always had strange yellow carpets, and were lit with ghastly floodlights or something. They're just very bright. All of this had probably something to do with the low resolution of TV screens at the time, but now that we're in the world of high def, you can actually use shadows in your television shows. Well, anyway, there was a long gap, and then a bunch of shows suddenly appeared a few weeks ago or last month that I'd been waiting for or am just watching because there isn't that much on, or I'm hate watching, which is the case with Lioness, I guess officially known as Special Ops Lioness, which is the latest Taylor Sheridan program. And the reason I'm hate-watching is because it's become clear that Taylor Sheridan, an actor turned writer who had appeared on the motorcycle TV show Sons of Anarchy, and who perhaps unfortunately learned too many lessons about creating character from that show. He had also written Sicario and Hell or High Water, and those are entertaining pieces, but this somber masculinist tone, which was somewhat puzzling at the time, now becomes clear after Yellowstone series and especially Lioness. This is a show in which essentially good people are doing tough jobs, receive no appreciation from their bosses or the American public, are really mean to each other, disdain weakness, and break laws left, right, and right down the middle. It stars Nicole Kidman and Zoe Saldana, along with Laisla de Oliveira and Michael Kelly. This first season lasts 8 episodes, and we're about halfway through it. And I guess I'll keep following the series, but again, with much more suspicion than I brought to Sicario, which is all in all, an excellent movie, and Hell or High Water, which is well acted, and Sheridan knows how to give actors nice, big, meaty little speeches that they can put in their reel. Another renewed program is Billions, in what is supposed to be its final season, and as often happens on TV shows, they basically regroup and start over. In other words, all the people who had been fired from their jobs are back in them. All the villains who had fled in previous seasons have returned. Everybody's back at the old desk and the team's back together. This time, once again, the alleged good guys, including Paul Giamatti as an attorney general, are up against the bad guys, in this case, someone named Michael Prince, who took over an investment firm and who was played by Corey Stahl. Again, the show looks good, but one of the program's appeals is the nonstop, the rather constant cultural references. Somebody is always like something else, or a situation always like something found in a movie. The more obscure, the better. This is an example of a show where you just want to find out what happens. And I suppose what one could do would be to watch all the previously ons from earlier episodes and then just watch the final episode to find out what's going on. But we will soldier through all the episodes. One of the better shows from last year was Only Murders in the Building, a program put together by Steve Martin and Martin Short, which is a parody of the world of true crime podcasts, set in a building that I suppose is meant to be the Dakota Building in Manhattan. Murders take place, a theater director and producer and the former TV crime show star get together with a young woman played by Selena Gomez to try to put together the podcast so they can make a little money whilst they're in dire straits. This season, however, is really star-packed. Not only does it feature Paul Rudd, but Meryl Streep, everybody's either favorite major performer or everybody's least favorite scenery chewer. Also appearing this season are Tina Fey and Andrea Martin, Martin Short's old comedy companion from Second City TV. I'm not going to say anything about the plot, except that it's set in a world of theater, and that so far it's funny and has enough red herrings to keep you guessing who did it. Finally, one of the shows that I've really been looking forward to is Justified City Primeval, a one-off season after the original Justified ended after six or so seasons. Stars Timothy Oliphant as the admirable U.S. Marshal created by Elmore Leonard. And the series really recreated the world of Elmore Leonard well. For example, the dialogue and the world of criminals and interesting interactions between cops and criminals and the critical perspective, the judginess of criminals towards their fellow thieves. That series had some great villains, and this one does too, in the form of Boyd Holbrook as Clement Mansell, along with an excellent turn by Adelaide Clemens as his female companion and intimidated devotee. This is a refashioning of an Elmore Leonard novel called City Primeval, set in Detroit, with many of the same characters, but it's been refashioned as a Raylan Givens story. I find it quite entertaining, if so far not quite as superb as some of the good seasons of Justified. But as I speak these words, we are between episode 7 and the climactic episode 8 that airs Tuesday night. So I'll be most excited to see how the story is resolved and what other changes they have enacted on the novel City Primeval. Now, let us turn to our Los Angeles correspondent, Jeff Gonsol, with his views on another Essentials of Cinema.
From the opening shot to the closing credits, while watching Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon from 1975, you might find yourself thinking, this is the most beautiful-looking movie ever made. That was true in 1975, and it's still true 45 years later. So striking are the images, particularly the stunning exteriors of the countrysides of England and Ireland and Germany. I was certain when I first saw it that matte shots were used to recreate such splendor, but I was wrong. Kubrick's then 19-year-old daughter, in her first work on a film, had scouted locations and took photos for the locations that were later used. In filming this 20th century movie of a 19th century novel of an 18th century story, Kubrick took great pains with every location and the impeccable costume design and the groundbreaking use of natural lighting, including candles. So Kubrick's most gorgeous-looking film follows his ugliest-looking, A Clockwork Orange, just 4 years before, and all to serve a purpose, whatever serves the story. And the story in Barry Lyndon is of the life and loves, the ups and downs, the trials and the tribulations of Redmond Barry, played by Ryan O'Neill. And these picturesque settings and this attention to detail does not serve as a mere backdrop to the goings-on. Rather, it's meant to frame them, much like the very Hogarth paintings that Kubrick used as his inspiration. More than once, Kubrick will begin a shot on a central detail and slowly zoom back to reveal the full majesty of the scene.
I have borne as long as mortal could endure the ill treatment of the insolent Irish upstart whom you have taken into your bed. It is not only the lowness of his birth and the general brutality of his manners which disgusts me, but the shameful nature of his conduct towards your ladyship, his brutal and ungentlemanlike behavior, his open infidelity, his shameless robberies and swindling of my property and yours. And as I cannot personally chastise this low-bred ruffian, and as I cannot bear to witness his treatment of you, and loathe his horrible society as if it were the plague, I have decided to leave my home and never return, at least during his detested life, or during my own.
And then there is also the narration, often witty and frequently prefacing the events that we're about to see unfold. Now, this entire approach by Kubrick seems to be daring us to remain involved, or as Roger Ebert put it in his original review in 1975, quote, defying us to care, forcing us to remain detached, unquote. The way I see it today, it's Kubrick giving us all a golden opportunity to miss the forest for the trees. And many of the worst of the big critics of the day simply took that bait. Charles Champlin of the LA Times called Barry Lyndon the movie equivalent of a large, heavy, expensive, and dull coffee table book. Pauline Kael, in all of her originality, also called it a coffee table book, a, quote, quick-witted story drained of all of its blood, unquote. How inept and short-sighted these critics look today, as Barry Lyndon has only grown in stature. At least Roger Ebert grew with it, putting it on his great movies list in 2009. Released as it was in the middle of the 70s when the new blood of the new Hollywood had changed the industry, Kubrick's leisurely pacing and sumptuous visuals look more audacious than ever. Barry Lyndon was a far cry from Easy Rider. Kubrick's work with his actors is, I believe, one of the more underappreciated aspects of his legacy. The evidence is right there on the screen. While the styles and, you could even say, the talent levels of his actors varied widely, their performances became as indelible as the films themselves. He chose wisely, and with Barry Lyndon, he got the perfect face with Ryan O'Neill. In scene after scene, Kubrick knows when to linger on the face of our hapless hero as he navigates through the ebb and flow of his own unpredictable fate. Barry Lyndon is also loaded with terrific performances from Kubrick regulars like Patrick McGee and Philip Stone. Essential to enjoying Barry Lyndon is, I think, as it is in all of Kubrick's films, is in seeing its humor. While presented with all sincerity and authenticity, the appearances and goings-on amongst the high society of 18th century England can be highly amusing indeed. Even poor Barry's poor predicaments themselves can be seen with a woeful amusement. Now, Kubrick is sometimes criticized for his detachment and low regard for his fellow men. But there's really an abundance of humanity in his films, and all the better seen with a sense of humor. Barry Lyndon is no exception. And finally, mention must be made of the wonderful musical score for the film. Kubrick used mostly period music for the film, pieces by Handel and Bach, but also traditional Irish folk music performed by the Chieftains. So well chosen, it is as if the music was scored for the film. The soundtrack album is one of the best ever. Watching Barry Lyndon recently was one of the most enjoyable and fastest 3 hours I could have spent. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff.
Catch us
and
up
don't forget
the
to drop in the Jeff's
My
website,
Salinger Year.
Essentials of Cinema, for more recommendations. And you're listening to Film at 11 here on Community Radio
KBOO Portland. Now, Matthew of KBOO's Gremlin Time, catch us up with the recent My Salinger Year.
Released in 2020, My Salinger Year is adapted from the autobiographical book by Joanne Smith Rakoff and was adapted by the Canadian director Philippe Faraudeau, a warm and witty comedy about a young writer named Joanne, played by Margaret Qualley, and it is set in New York in 1995. So as the movie opens, Joanne is addressing us in the audience and explaining why a year ago, while visiting her best friend in New York, she decided not to return to her studies or to her boyfriend in Berkeley. As she says, something flipped.
I want to stay in New York for a while.
A while? What do you mean a while? What about your semester?
Yeah, but see, that's just it. I don't want to analyze other people's work anymore, Carl. I want to write.
In New York?
Yeah. In New York. Isn't that what aspiring writers did? You know, live in cheap apartments and write in cafes? Yeah, I know. But it's what I wanted.
On one hand, this is a nice coming-of-age story as we follow Joanne as she, you know, finds a place to live. She ends up finding a new boyfriend, meeting new other friends, and she gets a job as a secretary in this literary agency. Now, this agency, besides handling other famous writers, handles J.D. Salinger. And being the new girl in the office, she is tasked with having to handle the fan mail that's been sent in to Salinger.
I'm Hugh. You must be Joanna.
Yes, hi. Nice to meet you.
Salinger's letters, fan mail. You need to answer them using these. There's one for each type of inquiry: adaptation, autobiography, autograph, photograph, interview.
Mr. Salinger does not wish to receive mail from his readers, thus we cannot pass your kind note on to him. 1963?
That's the year he stopped responding himself. You need to type the new one based exactly on this, verbatim, no change.
So Salinger doesn't get any of his mail?
Not one. You shred them. In the shredder.
You should always read them.
Yes, indeed.
Just in case.
Just in case.
In case of what?
We've been extra careful since the Mark David Chapman thing.
John Lennon's assassin. When the police arrived at the Dakota, they found Chapman calmly sitting on a sidewalk reading Catcher in the Rye. At his trial, Chapman said that the big part of him was Holden Caulfield.
And the small part of him was the devil.
Did Chapman write to Salinger?
We'll never know since we throw away the mail.
Read everything thoroughly. Use your judgment.
And so Joanne sets to work reading these letters, and she's begin to feel for these people who have written in and kind of want to take their case in some instances. In one point, she's afraid that this one young man is going to commit suicide, and so she takes it to her boss, Margaret, who was wonderfully played by Sigourney Weaver.
He's challenging Jerry. It's a game, and you're falling for it.
I feel this boy just deserves a proper response, not our usual bullshit.
You are confusing judgment with empathy. I have read hundreds of letters just like this one. It can get overwhelming, but just do your job.
Now, this is a very familiar story. We have the young artist who has to do the bidding of others to get by, and at the same time has to kind of hide their true character. Here she wants to be a writer, but she doesn't bring that up to the literary agents because they don't think that makes a good assistant. So she's pretending to just be a secretary when really she's a writer. And so this narrative is kind of broken up because we start with this narration of hers. So here she is writing the story of what led up to her having to tell her boss that she's going to give notice because she wants to do something else. And so the first part of the film is a narration flashback as she gets her apartment and finds a new boyfriend, gets this job, and finds out what she has to do at the job, and it's these letters to a Salinger, and then how they affect her and how she fantasizes about the people who have sent this in. And so the story is very loose, and it breaks into fits of fancy now and then, but it's also kind of somber in some experiences that happen to the characters that she witnesses in this year. And so then the story brings us up to the point when she gives her notice. And at that point, the narration is dropped and the story kind of continues on its own. And like I said, this is kind of like in a Truffaut film, Francois Truffaut. He had said how you start in the middle, you work towards the beginning, and then the ending takes care of itself. And so this narrative is in play in this movie. Also, the way the film is shot, it's a great set design. You've got boxes within boxes. You'll have Joanne at her desk, and Sigourney Weaver is in her office. And then there's another office to the side, and the character moves in and out there. And so people are framed in doorways. There's a scene where she's arguing with her boyfriend, and she's sitting out on the porch, and he moves into the front room and into a back room and comes back out, and he moves into another room, and the conversation is almost given in one shot. There's a couple of cutaways, but it's almost just one shot, and the character's moving in and out. This technique is used throughout the movie where characters move through the set, but it doesn't detract from the movie, like say in a Wes Anderson film where he's being really clever, and the way the film is being framed and presented almost competes with the narrative. And you know, you can see that especially like in the Budapest Hotel and all the different fancy stuff that goes on in that. But this movie, it doesn't compete with the narrative, and it lets the actors perform within the space that's set up for them. And so, like I say, this is a familiar story of the young actor, the young artist coming of age, but it's told in a rather unique and plausible way that doesn't detract from the story. So, like I say, this is a familiar narrative, but it's got an interesting look at the love of books, about writing, and about a coming of age, of having to do something that's unpleasant, but you have to do it, and that you have to make decisions in your life. And the character of Joanne makes one decision after another and moves on into the next part of her life where she's starting to become a writer. And so this is My Salinger Year from 2020, and it's by Philippe Faraday, a Canadian director, and it stars Margaret Qualley and Sigourney Weaver. It's a film well worth watching more than once.
Thanks again, Matthew, and again, thank you for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday, so until then, keep watching the screens. Oh, come on, baby, but never cool.
body sweating, babe.
Thank you.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Stupid Cupid, you're a real mean guy.
Hey, KBOO listeners. Join us at the station on February 7th from 6 to 10 p.m. for our Stupid KBOOFID First Friday Arts Walk. Enjoy art.